Mental strength, are we born with it or is it a learned skill? That's one of the questions we'll be putting to our special guest this evening. Hi, my name's Andy Rice, coming to you from the UK, and out in Auckland, a free man once again is Hamish Wilcox. So Hamish, what does freedom feel like?
Yeah, it's really good. I mean, I think it was one of the toughest thoughts of mine to go, 14 days into a hotel. I've never been more than about, 12 hours between flights in a hotel, and that's when you can just walk outside whenever you want and, and have a wander around the block or whatever. But yeah, no, it was a real challenge for me. I put myself mentally at the real bottom, thinking that if I survived it, I'd be doing well. So expectations were as low as they possibly could be. I think that helped a bit.
Well, that's a great mental skill in itself that you've just shared there. Now, before we ask our special guest for all his advice and wisdom, what quarantine advice do you have, Hamish, for our special guest, Jimmy Spithill?
Well, Jimmy's done a few, but yeah, it's like a long haul flight, eh? You can't look at your watch the 24 hour flight to Europe that we normally persevere with is obviously becomes a 14 day all through MIQ at the end, and I think Jimmy's already got it. We asked him what day it was. He didn't know, so he's already got that one.
Well, Jimmy, let's bring you in. Thanks very much for joining us. So tell us, just a few days ago, a lot of us were watching you race the AC, not the AC50 anymore, the F50, let's call it, around the racetrack at Sale GP Italy, and here you are in Auckland. What brings you to Auckland?
Oh, thanks, Andy, and thanks, Hamish, for having me on. Really stoked to be able to sit down and chat with you guys and everyone that's tuning in, I guess. It was fantastic to go racing the F50. It was just great to be back in Italy, actually. We were chatting before this call, and I honestly can't really remember the last time I did a competitive race in Italy. Obviously, given the past America's Cup campaign, you get a real sense of how passionate and how into sailing Italians are. But when you're actually in Italy competing, given, I guess, what's happened over the past, few years, man, you just forget how passionate and into, well, sailing and sport in general, but especially sailing. So yeah, it was just awesome to be there and racing, especially given what's obviously going on in the world, or has been going on in the world over the the past year or so.
Well, Jimmy, I want to take you back quite a long way back before we dig into the meat of the questions. I want to see if you recognize this quote that a young sailor once made. And that sailor said, "It's sad, but it's all over for Peter Gilmore. It's just life. He's 42 years old. He's got old legs and old arms. He just can't keep up. If you're over 25, you've got to get off the boat, mate." Now, Jimmy, do you know who said that?
Yeah, I think that was me. But funny enough, I actually was referring to tennis. And at that time, we had a pretty fierce rivalry going where I think Peter Gilmore and Charlie McKee had teamed up in the doubles tennis court, and myself and Ben Durham were there sort of competitive, the guys were going against, and this was during the One World Challenge days. And it was a really cool time because I remember that, we were full on at work. It was really intense at work. And I think what we were missing was that ability to get together away from work and finding, let's say, the environment that worked, because, both Charlie and Peter were married with kids and, as I highlighted, older. And both, let's say, myself and the young group of guys, and I guess Ben Durham, we were not married. We didn't have kids. And so we're in quite a different situation. But anyway, the point being was we're in the same team, and to help build that relationship, we needed to find an outlet or a way to get together, And so this became it. And so we just had this healthy banter going on every day at work after each tennis game on who would win. And so, yeah, that was after just a dominating victory by Ben and I. So I was obviously high with confidence.
Well, talking of tennis, Hamish, you just come back from 3 weeks of paddle tennis in Spain. That was why you went there, and you won the contest there. You did do a bit of coaching with Pete and Blair during the day as well, but you were with Jimmy for the 2007 Cup with Luna Rossa. Is that correct?
That's right.
And so, out of you two, who would win at paddle tennis right now?
Yeah, well, I think Jimmy would have to be on his game at the moment, actually, after almost 3 weeks and 2 hours a day. Yeah, Jimmy's a bit of a risk taker, so he'd need to be getting his shots in. And I'd just be getting the ball back, waiting for him to make a mistake. So it just probably depend a lot on his mental skills, as whether he is really focused enough to get all those, all those high-risk shots in.
Well, Jimmy, we've got you here to ask you about your mental skills. And you actually said some very interesting things on the YouTube from the weekend from SailGP. And one of the quotes I saw you make was, I believe any champion athlete can be made, can be trained. I truly believe you only have to look at history. Michael Jordan wasn't picked as one of the top draft picks. Tom Brady was another top draft pick for quarterbacks. So that seems to be your view. So I want to ask you, Hamish talks about in Road to Gold, he talks about the dirty side of your vase, the weaknesses that we never dare look at on the other side of the vase, the one that gathers dust. Did you ever have a dirty side of your vase as far as mental skills were concerned, or did you come into the world with a large amount of confidence and self-belief already?
No, I think definitely at a younger age, I was, really quite, nervous and really shy. And I think it was a lot of probably maybe a bit of where I grew up. But yeah, and probably the equipment I started out with, but pretty quickly and quite fortunately, I sort of started to learn some pretty key lessons. And in that being that, it's, yeah, you're, let's face it, your equipment is very, very important in the sport of sailing. But I think one of the other key factors is the amount of time you put in and that the hours add up. And so that, I think that was, a key lesson early on. But yeah, for sure. When I started out, I was, I was sort of going from doing it as more of a way of life and, what we do when we got home from school for fun, and then going to, let's say, a competitive environment. It was just quite different to, I guess, how I started out sailing and why I started out to sail.
The other thing that you've said is that you, by the nature of the colour of your hair, by growing up with red hair, that was in itself quite character building. I don't know if you're joking about that or if you're being serious.
Probably a bit of both. Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, and I think, kids, I think it's probably every kid goes through some sort of character building or, let's say, moment that's, uncomfortable or forces them to have to respond or do something. And yeah, definitely. I mean, I'd say probably nowadays it's, in general, people are a lot more accepting of differences, and that's probably more like a celebrated thing. But certainly, yeah, when I grew up, there's no doubt about it. Yeah, there was some character building along the way, which at the time was uncomfortable, I'd say almost frightening. But when I look back on it, was actually really, really important and quite critical. And I find myself in a difficult situation now because being a dad and having a couple of kids, the last thing you want or wish for your children is, let's say, difficult times. And you have this instinct of wanting to jump in or let's say protect them. But if I look at my own experience and growing up, it was actually those moments that were probably the most important. So it's a strange situation I find myself in now where, I obviously, you want to naturally jump in and, you know, and protect them. But on the flip side, if I look back at my own experience, those are actually the most important times, and some lessons you have to learn the hard way.
You said that because you had red hair, you learned to run. And then when you can't run anymore, you learn to fight. And is this what led to the boxing, or again, was that really a bit of a good line or some truth to that?
No, there was definitely some truth to that. It's amazing how fast you can run when you're being chased. But yeah, the boxing really started. It was just I still remember it. You know, I was with a bunch of mates, and we just, you know, copped a bit of a hiding from, you know, I guess some bullies, and we're literally just sort of slowly making our way back, I think, to a bus stop or on our way home, kind of licking our wounds. And we walked through this industrial area, and this boxing gym had just opened up there. And I'll just never forget this big Tongan guy who was the coach just standing at the front. And it was as if he had almost sensed kind of what had happened. And he basically just said, "Hey boys, do you want to come in and, you know, do a bit of training?" And so that was the kickoff to that. I mean, that was just a massive moment in my life, because the most important thing was he was just an amazing coach, and just someone, let's say, as a mentor, that just really sort of ingrained in me, you know, a lot of things like discipline and hard work and kind of doing the right thing and just a bunch of things. But also the fact that, you know, a lot of the, let's say, the problems and the issues were happening out there, the sport just kept showing that none of that stuff really mattered. And if you ever want to see a sport where, well, I think they all apply, but let's say in boxing, there's no hiding and there's no shortcut. You know, you can't trick yourself into you know, thinking you can get away with not training very hard. I mean, you're going against people that are the same weight, you know, putting the same amount of training, and it really exposes you, you know, and it really puts you in some uncomfortable situations. So, yeah, it was just one of those key moments that at that point I basically just stopped running.
Stopped running and started fighting, and you've been boxing ever since. And I wonder how important you feel the boxing is to your performance in sailing.
Well, I think it honestly could have been anything. And I did a lot of sports going through high school and that. But I think the thing with boxing was, yeah, again, that it straight off the bat just sort of taught you that you can't judge a book by its cover. Because, you know, when you think of someone, let's say, that's good at self-defense or I don't know, like someone you'd fear, it'd probably be like an image of guy with huge muscles, mean looking guy, whatever, you know, like, where in actual fact the guys that were the best were what I call a wolf in sheep's clothing. You actually, if you looked at them, you'd have no idea. And so, yeah, so that was straight off the bat, where you would just see example after example of someone that looked the part, but then actually the guy that would get the job done and win actually sometimes didn't look the part, you know. So that was a pretty important lesson, that you couldn't really underestimate anyone, and that the, you know, the harder you work, the luckier you sort of got. And so, yeah, it was just starting to see certain trends like that really started to hit home to me. But the biggest one I would have said was having support and having good people around you. And in terms of that experience, it was just having a couple of coaches that almost became like a second father to me. And it was something away from what I was doing at that time. And that's something, as you get on in your sporting career, especially in team sport, you start to see how important it is to be surrounded by good people, but not just on the boat, you know, especially off the boat. That lesson I learned, I may not have not really known it at the time, but that lesson I definitely learned early on in that sport that I was doing.
It seems like you're big into the idea of cross training and bringing ideas from other sports into sailing. And Hamish, that's always been a big part of what you do, and it's a big part of what we talk about on Road to Gold. So I wonder if you've got any observations here about the different skills. I mean, maybe it's hand-eye coordination in boxing as well as the pure courage to get in the ring, but you talk about the benefits of mountain biking and the balance sports as well, and how that can feed back into high performance sailing. Just tell us how you see that, and how you think that compares with Jimmy's approach.
Well, I think when you get involved in sport with the people you're around already, you know, let's say the group I'm with, which is Peter and Blair and the training partners and other support people around that group, you actually put yourself under pressure in a different environment, and you gauge a lot, you learn a lot about each other in that process. And I think that it all really, really helps because you've got to be able to plug all the gaps to have a complete team that's going to win. You know, you can't have a certain aspect that's not being attended to. And I think you get to learn what those aspects are, which no one's really looking at, you know, whether it's the equipment or whether it's the fitness, or whether it's, you know, getting through 2 hours on the paddle court and drinking enough, you know, I mean, putting it really simplistically. But for sure, I think it's learning about each other, learning about where the gaps might be, and just having that banter and the chat around the whole thing, you know, really does create quite a unique bond between you as well, and makes you stronger. So I think you're learning individually, but you're also learning as a group, and whatever you do in sport. And I think one of the interesting things, I was lying awake last night thinking about what I asked Jimmy, and it's a tricky question to ask to get it right, but I'm kind of curious to know that what you, because I think you're really, really strong mentally, Jimmy, you're known for that, and you know, you can see it on the heart rate monitor unless you're dicking around with it and the cup, you know, it was extraordinary. You know, you're obviously doing very little work there, driving the boat. No, but what I think is interesting as a question is, when you're chatting to other people, other sports people, and, you know, you're getting, this chat could be about it, anything, but it's often about competition. What are the things that you notice when you're talking to them? And I'm talking about, you know, people, not at the highest level, but people kind of in that next group down when you're having a chat. What are the things you notice that are different to the way they're thinking compared to the way you're thinking when you're having that chat? You know, it's a difficult question to answer, and you may want to come back to it. But I'm just sort of trying to gauge, you know, you've got, you know, extraordinary mental fortitude and resilience. And I'm just thinking, what are the things you notice when you're chatting to other people where they're, the conversation leads you to think, oh, I wonder if he's really, you know, he's trying to take the easy way, you know, maybe not really considering lifting every stone, looking for the opportunity to improve, or, you know, what's the kind of, is there some themes that come through that are repetitive themes when you notice chatting about competition with people that aren't winning those competitions? It'd be helpful to know.
Yeah, thanks for the easy question, Hamish. No, look, I think exactly what you've said. I mean, I guess for me, it started out in that, I'll just be completely candid and honest with you. I don't think I have the talent, any more talent, let's say, than someone living next door or the guy down the road. So for me, the approach was, okay, I really forced into I'm going to have to outwork these guys, you know, or I'm really going to have to look under every stone and try and tick all of the boxes. And then as it grew into, let's say, you know, more team-based stuff, it became pretty apparent every time I surrounded myself with guys better than me, we'd be doing pretty well, because that would force me to have to work really hard to try and sort of get up to their level at the same time. But one thing, yeah, that does stand out is, and I think this can actually be a trap if you've got a lot of talent, in that maybe you get away with not doing every single thing that you could do. And if you do, well, then you're a LeBron James, or then you're one of these freak talents, you know. But sometimes you can get away, those sort of guys can get away with not doing everything. And so I sort of felt like I didn't have that option. It had to be an all-in approach. And sometimes, yeah, chatting to those guys that were just not there, you would see that, you know, they wouldn't make that sacrifice. They wouldn't get up before the others would get up. They wouldn't stay longer than the others. They wouldn't put that extra bit of time and energy in the training. Even nowadays, you know, nutrition. I mean, I've always tried to look for every competitive advantage I can get. And I think there's a lot out there, but it's not an easy road, you know. And so, yeah, when I see that, I always think, well, yeah, I'm just not 100% convinced this guy's going to get to the top because there's some real he's missing a few steps there.
Good answer. Thanks, mate.
I've got a follow-on question from Steve, who asks you, Jimmy. He says, well, there must be a difference between confidence and mental toughness. What would you say to the assertion, whilst it's possible to build confidence, you can't teach mental fortitude?
Yeah, I come from the... It's a tough one to answer. I mean, I believe you can teach and train anyone as long as they've got the attitude that they want to learn and that they're willing to make that commitment. And the reason I say that is I've just seen it. You know, I've seen it in my own experience. I've seen it, you know, being involved with and running America's Cup teams where, yeah, there's certain guys that fit the bill. You know, they have the talent, they've got all the necessary skills. But every now and then you get a guy that just comes through under the radar and he may not have, let's say, been on your top three lists to hire for a position, but he just sort of fights its way in there just to get in the team. He'll do any role or position. He'll start out just in the, you know, whether he's in the short team or just doing jobs around the base and somehow just absolutely fight his way into the team and get there. And then ironically, when you get to a super tough, high pressure moment, you know, call it a match point or, you know, a tough situation, whatever it is, interestingly enough, he's usually the guy that's stepping up in that moment, not so much so, let's say, the typical person you may expect that sort of shone initially. So yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I answered your question there, but I think it's a balance that, yeah, of course, you need confidence and somewhat mental toughness. But I think a lot of that comes from the preparation you put in, also going through some good and bad moments. You know, I mean, that's all part of the process, I believe, of that. Yeah, I see very few personality conflicts when you're winning and things are going great. Where you really see the guy, well, where I see guys I want to start with and be surrounded by is actually in the tough moments and the bad moments. And that's kind of strange because you obviously don't want to go out there and do those bad moments. It's not like, oh, my big strategy is, guys, let's go out there and just throw a few races and put ourselves in a real bad situation here. But through experience and through time, I think that's where you sort of learn some of those traits is because you have to be completely open and expose yourself and really be quite candid about, well, what isn't working here and, you know, what are our weaknesses and how do we learn from that?
Did you happen to see the Formula One Grand Prix last weekend?
I read about it. Yeah. It sort of reminded me of a recent race.
It reminded me of a recent race. So there was a certain Red Bull athlete, Max Verstappen, that was headed home for a fairly easy victory in Azerbaijan. And then he had a Pirelli tyre blowout on him. And it was the second tyre incident that had blown out. And he saw that race go up in a puff of smoke because the only bit of kit that the Red Bull racing team don't make themselves gave up on him. Now, somebody else had a tyre blowout on the weekend in Taranto. And so... what is a useful response to that? How long do you give yourself when your equipment gives up on you and you end up losing the Sale GP weekend through no fault of your own? How long do you give yourself to get angry before you put yourself on the reset to actually pull yourself together again and get your head together. Although it was the last race anyway, so I guess if you did throw your toys out the pram, you had all afternoon to put them back in the pram again.
Yeah, and a couple of weeks in quarantine too. But no, look, I think at the end of the day that I mean, what makes sports so compelling and I think exciting is that it doesn't always go to script. And there's always, no matter how well you prepare and do, let's say, the perfect preparation and, you know, you tick every single box, there's no guarantees, you know. And I actually really like that about sport, because that's what makes it so tough and engaging and at times character building. And I think, you know, looking at our situation, you as a competitor and someone that's very competitive, there's no doubt that you it's such a natural feeling to be pissed off when something like that happens. And you see not only yourself, but your teammates and everyone else around you, your shore team, and that all be just as disappointed and frustrated as you. But then I think that what happens quite well over time, what happens quite quickly is you really have to reflect back and look at, you know, the event, how you really sailed, and be quite honest with yourself. Because let's use that race as an example. I actually thought that's probably the best race we've raced since joining the Sail GP. And so some other times you may race a race and actually maybe win it, but not sail that well and do a pretty ordinary job, make a whole bunch of mistakes. And so for me, that was the most important part. When I look back at the series and how we'd learned and progressed through the weekend and got to that race, the way we executed that race, I was so proud of the team and how we responded and set it up. I'm not sure I really would have changed anything up until that point when we hit that object about how we're racing. You know, it really had put it together. So that was such an encouraging part looking back at the regatta. So now I have the so here's the opportunity. Should I spend my time and energy thinking about a completely random event that happened, hitting something under the water? Actually quite different, in some ways different than, let's say, that Formula One race, because that was a technical piece of equipment breaking. Ours is we just hit a random, I mean, you'd guess it'd be like a cow running onto the racetrack, you know, and their car hitting it, in that the boat didn't break. It was just, you know, sort of hit a brick wall. So anyway, my point is I could spend that time thinking about that and the odds of it happening and, you know, going round and round and round. Or I could really look back at the week and say, righto, what do we need to do? Let's look at, you know, what worked well, what didn't work well, and really focus the time and energy that's going to help us get even more competitive in Plymouth. You know, what do we need to work on? What did we do well? What did we didn't? That's the key thing for me, you know, is being quite quick to react and say, okay, let's, you know, we can't control everything. That was clearly something we couldn't control. Where do we want to put our time and energy? And to me, it would just make no sense spending any time on it. I mean, almost to the point of we actually had a bit of a laugh about it and used a bit of black humor about it. And that was a way as a group to, let's say, get on with it and get over it. Like, yeah, of course, we're pissed off and we, you know, there would have been a bit of swearing when it happened and all that. But quite quickly, it was, man, we were all just shaking hands, saying, oh, great series, guys, having a bit of a laugh about it. All right. Real quickly, the conversation turned, okay, what do we need to improve for the next event? So that, my point is, you have to really focus on what's going to help you get better as a team and an athlete and help you, give you a better chance at winning races. And spending time on that sort of a situation, let's face it, doesn't matter how much time you would spend on it, it's not going to change it in any way, and it's not going to affect that happening in the future anyway.
Well, yeah, I mean, that makes absolute sense what you say. It's just that I don't think all of us are able to move on quite so easily as that. So presumably that's something that you've trained yourself to do as well. I mean, lots of us have sleepless nights about things that happened in the past, but maybe you don't. Is that an issue that you've managed to put to bed many years ago?
Yeah, I think it happened over time. You just learn that you've only got so much time and energy during the day. And so my belief, or what I started to see work, was you may as well spend it on the things that really are going to help you be more competitive or give you a better chance at winning. And so, and that sort of became more apparent the more I progressed through the different campaigns, and especially, let's say, being more involved in the running of the team, because quite quickly you start to get to a point where the sailing actually becomes, let's say, somewhat of a small part of your day. And it's quite easy to get distracted in other topics. It could be fundraising, it could be people issues on the shore or planning and all these sort of things. So at a certain point, you just kind of can't do everything, and then go home and have a family and, you know, play a decent role in that. So at a certain point, you start thinking, okay, well, how am I going to manage my time here? And you got to be pretty honest too, you know, like what do I really need to work on, or what do we as a group need to work on? So yeah, pretty quickly it becomes apparent that worrying about things that are out of your control and spending too much time and energy on that is a complete waste of time.
Jimmy, thank you for that. Hamish, any response to that from your side?
Yeah, no, I'm fascinated by all the comments that are coming out, and it's great when you see a story along with it. You know, you can relive the moment, and I think that's a really powerful point. Talking about the, you know, what's coming through to me over and over is just this hunger and this desire to want to keep learning and keep improving. And I think a comment that I think Jimmy would probably agree to is that this, you know, confidence isn't something that you're just born with. It's something, you know, that you have to work on, and you get confident by just being better, by training harder and technically getting better and, you know, physically getting better, and all the chapters of Road to Gold have to be ticked at 100%, and then you've got confidence. And it's just really, really good. It's really cool to hear these stories coming through.
Well, we've got a lot of good questions coming through. Let me see if we can fire through some of them. Just to follow up on what we were just talking about, Steve comments that Tiger Woods gives himself 10 seconds to be cross after a bad shot, and then it's over, move on. So something I'm sure you can relate to, Jimmy, and maybe you can even beat the 10-second barrier that Tiger's got. Right, let's see. Now, Satu, you always ask great questions, and it would be great to get you on to ask those questions directly to Jimmy. So let's get you in there. Hi, Satu. Nice to see you.
Hi, nice to see you too. And nice to see you, Jimmy. Like this live, I've been watching you only from my TV, and exciting with you in the games. So very nice to see you.
You've got three great questions. I think maybe number two, how do you face disappointments? I think maybe we've just answered that, but shoot with number one.
Yeah. I know, Jimmy, that you already have great, wonderful self-confidence, but do you still do something, mental games or anything that kind of boosts that onwards in a difficult situation or anything like that?
So building blocks for self-confidence, that's what you want to know about. Give us your yes. A to Z of building self-confidence, Jimmy.
Well, I think building self-confidence for me, the first thing is you have to be really honest with yourself, you know, like what do I need to work on? I think when things don't go well, not hiding from the uncomfortable topics, you know, it's very, you know, I think sometimes you'll go into programs and you'll see it's real easy to talk about what you're good at, you know, or debrief what went really well, where the biggest growth rate is typically what didn't go well and why. And so to me, that's an important part, because that, I know it seems strange talking about self-confidence, but the more, let's say, vulnerable you can be and expose yourself, actually, the more I've found the more confidence I've got from it, because that to me is an uncomfortable feeling. So I think the other part is I take self-confidence in the people around me. You know, when I look at the people around me and the attitude they display and putting the team before themselves, but also in your preparation, you know yourself if you've taken any shortcuts. But when you know you've put in the time and the dedication in the lead up to a big event, you can take self-confidence in that. You know, you can truly say to yourself, well, look, we've done all, we've followed all these steps, we've put in the time, our, you know, technical side, the preparation, the physical side. And that to me, when all of those parts come together, that really does affect the mental side, because it gives you the self-confidence that, well, yeah, we deserve to be competing here. We can go in with confidence of knowing we have a shot because we haven't taken any shortcuts and we've put in the hard work.
Great. Satu, your third question. Give us that one.
Yeah, so the third question then. What is your view on the sport psychologists in the coaching team as part of the physical and the sailing coaching team?
I think some of these sports psychologists would probably have a field day in some of these teams. It'd be one hell of an experience for them, because there's so many different characters in the game. I actually have I don't have a huge amount of experience with sports psychologists. It's something that does fascinate me because, you know, I'm super fascinated with, let's say, the human brain and how you make decisions, and especially under pressure. It's been one of the cool things being involved and having a relationship with Red Bull is that they have a big high performance department, and it's all about, and you get access to all these different athletes, you know, and especially a lot of them take significant risk. And so it's really cool to sort of understand what, you know, how do they make these decisions? And when, as we all know, when you get to a team environment, it just gets exponentially harder, you know, because you're not just sort of, let's say, dealing with that one athlete that's going out to perform. You've got to do it to a collective group that all have different strengths and weaknesses, all have different, come from potentially different cultures, and let's face it, all have different personalities. And that's a strength. You know, if we're all the same, it'd be pretty boring. But look, I guess my view on it is anything that can help you understand a decision-making process and somewhat make it better has got to be a good thing. And so to me, the ability to have an open mind and not be closed off to any potential learning opportunity like that would be a huge mistake. So yeah, look, I think there'd be a lot to learn there, but personally, I just have had I just don't have any experience there.
Jimmy, that surprises me. It sounds like there's a stone that hasn't been turned over yet. Is that because you feel that you're okay? You're sort of hitting 9 or 10 out of 10 in that department already, and you don't really need the help?
No, definitely not. It's more, I guess, what I've been drawn to, and I think really fortunate, you know, and I mentioned sort of the Red Bull, that high performance department, is that I've had the ability to speak to other athletes at a high level and other coaches. So I think in a lot of ways, that's probably been, let's say, my access to a sports psychologist, because I've been able to speak to, let's say, someone that's not a sailor. It could be someone that's a climber or a big wave surfer, and, you know, a bunch of just all these different athletes, and try and understand them, or how do they deal with fear or anxiety and all these different things that a lot of these guys do, or coaches. So I think for me, that's probably been, I guess, my access to a sports psychologist. But yeah, again, I'm looking for I need all the help I can get. So I'm looking for any advantage I can get. And man, it's, yeah, definitely, you know, understanding from some of these, well, let's say successful sports psychologists would be amazing. And I guess, yeah, I've sort of experienced it a little bit just through dealing with different athletes and, let's say, coaches from outside of our game.
Well, that is an incredible resource. And I've always wondered what it is like to be a Red Bull athlete and what the hidden benefits of that are. And you've just given us a little insight into that and being able to meet and mix with people from such diverse backgrounds and who really know the meaning of courage in ways that perhaps as sailors we will never need to. The people with wingsuits that fly through a hole in a rock at 200 miles an hour, for example. We've got a question from Steve asking, what do you, Hamish, think about sports psychology?
Yeah, well, it's a similar answer to Jimmy's in a way. It reminds me of that question we asked about starting some time ago when Santi Longhi was there. You know, I think that I've got a huge fascination about it and, you know, really a real hunger to learn. But I've never worked directly with a sports psychologist before. I haven't had the experience where my athletes have been either as in a coaching role. But it's not to say that there's not a lot of thought gone into it. And I think more recently, you know, we've been working with this, he's more of a brain neurologist, I guess. He has an understanding of how the brain works and why we're sort of programmed to make decisions, you know, the fright and flight and, you know, all your typical instinctive, you know, things that happen from a caveman style programming. And I found that fascinating. And I think what that's done as well is has created a language around the psyche, a shared language that, you know, I'm able to then, you know, we're, you know, able to then, you know, communicate these emotions, which are really, really hard to put into words. And so if you sort of know where you are on the language side, it's really helpful as a team to say, well, okay, this is where I was, or, you know, and they know what you mean. So it's just that common language. I think there's been some real help in that.
Does that depersonalize something that often our egos struggle to deal with then, Hamish, in the sense that if you talk about that emotion that you just felt, you talk about it as that thing over there that you can all relate to, does it enable you as a team to have a more honest conversation?
Yeah, I think it's also we're not very well, we don't talk about emotions. So we're not really good at it and we don't have the words to describe the feelings we're having. So it's difficult. It's usually, as I come back to, I think it's usually the case of just a language, you know, just, you know, discovering a language where you can actually talk about those moments, those key moments, those sort of match points and what's going on. And I think, you know, it's always discussed, isn't it, that the difference between the top athletes is actually the mental. You know, you look at a tennis match and, you know, I've been watching Roland Garros for a week. But, you know, you can clearly see that the skills on the court are pretty similar. But there's key moments in the game when one player steps up and overwhelms the other player, whether they outthink them or whether they, you know, manage to, you know, recognise a weakness that's been exploited on their side or a weakness that they can exploit on their side. And I think, you know, that the players that do that better, who understand how to do that better, are going to win the match. So it is a, you know, it is all related to a learning, thinking, mental skills game. In a way, everything is.
Hamish, thanks for that. Jimmy, I'm wondering, you're only what, in day two or day three, you've got lots more time to go through Road to Gold. What's your impression of Road to Gold so far? And what was your Road to Gold when you were growing up?
Well, I think when you look at the world we're currently living in, it's, you know, it's a tough period, I think, for a lot of us that are used to just having that flexibility to go out and sort of just travel here, do what we want, jump on a flight and be quite flexible. So it's quite a different world. But you've got to say, when you look at some, you know, I hate to say some, let's say some good things to come from COVID, I think one of the good things has been the tools that are out there that enable you to continue learning. So in the past, we've been able to, let's say, travel, move around, and get those experiences by physically going and doing something. But now I think COVID has forced us to figure out, okay, how can we do this being based where we are right now? And so how do we, you know, sort of think a way around that? And to me, when you look at the tools available now online to be educated about, let's face it, most things in the world, to me, I mean, the Road to Gold program is in a lot of ways a no-brainer because it's a way that you can, you know, get online, look at some of these tools, some of these methods, hear from different people that have different backgrounds and experiences, and then apply that in a way that can help you grow as well. So yeah, it's good timing, this program, because yeah, I do have a couple of weeks to try and get better leading into this next event for me, that's for sure.
Fantastic, Jimmy. Well, we're putting something together called The Test, which will be out next month. And so when we've put the test together, we're going to put you through the test, Jimmy, and see how highly you score on that. Yeah, anyway, thank you very much for that. We've got some really good questions here. Let's see if Russ and Penny Clark are available to ask their question directly to Jimmy.
Screen up. Hi, Andy. Hi, Jimmy. Hi, Hamish.
Hey.
Hey, guys.
Jimmy, I've got a question for you. I'm just going to pull it up because I wrote it hours ago, and it's just been fascinating since we started. This question about mental strength specifically during regattas or events is, what mental tools do you use when you're ahead in a series compared to those when you're behind? What would you offer me as an enthusiastic amateur to manage regatta expectations in a major event? I think I'd like to be good at compartmentalizing. So if you have a bad mark rounding or a bad leg or a bad race, you can put it behind you. But I'm quite an emotional character and tend to dwell on things. So I'd just be interested in your perspective on those kind of mental building blocks. Thanks.
Yeah, no worries. Well, I think you're dead on exactly what you said, is that I think the ability to try and move on, especially, you know, after a mistake, is probably one of the most important aspects that I've found. Because again, once something happens, you've only got so much time and energy until the next, let's say, key decision or the next key race or key moment is about to come up. And if you carry that baggage, and I know this from personal experience, making this mistake so many times, where especially, let's say, an umpire call, let's say a bad umpire call or something like that, you can carry this forever. I mean, you can just rethink, man, they got that wrong, what were they thinking? And instead of just sort of really taking it back to quite quickly of, okay, look, they probably did get it wrong, they're only human, and okay, let's move on. What else can I do now to go out and win this race? You know, I can't go back in time and change that call, or I can't go back and undo the mistake I did for a mark rounding or whatever it is. But what I can do is potentially look at, could I have done something a little bit different leading into that decision? So I didn't even have to put it into the umpire's hands. Was that my only option? And also, I think understanding the fact of, well, maybe it was just a bad call. Maybe it's just one of those things in sport and life we know where it just didn't work out. But over time and over a regatta, if you spend your time and energy really focusing on, you know, what the key points are and looking forwards and trying to take those lessons, that shouldn't really matter at the end of the day, that call. It shouldn't be the deciding factor or that mark rounding, et cetera. The deciding factor will be how you deal with it, how you learn from it, and then apply that in the next situation that comes up.
And do you use a different process? So if you're in control of a situation, you talked earlier about adversity and, you know, the incident at the weekend with the rudder and hitting something. But if you're behind and you're the one that's the aggressor and you're trying to make gains, you've got the confidence you can do so, but do you use a sort of different set of skills? If you're doing well, I find we talk a lot about doing well and then looking back at adversity rather than trying to improve and move your way up over a period of time during an event.
Yeah, I think what we, especially let's say in this type of racing that we're doing at the moment, one thing we really try and focus on is whether we're ahead or behind, actually have the same environment on the boat. So, and as we all know, when you're ahead, it's much easier to have a nice steady flow of, you know, communication, you know, the talk is up, people are focusing on the right things. When you get behind, sometimes almost a sense of panic can start to enter into, you know, into it. I mean, people tend to shut down a little bit more, especially if if you've made the mistake yourself in the team environment, it's easier to sort of naturally just shut down because you, let's say you obviously you feel bad about the mistake or that you've just done. But in actual fact, that's probably the most important time to just keep that process and everything rolling along, because the best way to make a decision, I've learned when you're behind, is to keep doing all those processes, you know, keep that communication flow going, not panicking, not making a super high risk decision, and really trying to think a step or two ahead. Don't get me wrong, there are certain times in a race where you may get to the point where, okay, now we have to take some risk. You know, we've been there, we've been chipping away, we're just slowly, you know, waiting for an opportunity to present itself, and it may not. And okay, now is the time to take some real risk here. But for the most part, I think, yeah, the more you can be, you can have the same environment, flow of information, decision-making process, being ahead, being behind, that is critical. And what one of the game changers I found for myself and in the game today has been the use of a microphone. It just sounds so simple. But I remember cameras being a game changer. I remember this was in early 2000. We started introducing cameras on board our training in the America's Cup. And at first, none of the guys wanted them. You know, everyone was super scared about them and no one wanted them. After just a couple of sessions with the cameras, when we'd come back and debrief, real quickly, no one would go out on the boat unless the cameras are on. And then I found the same thing with the microphones, because you'd come back and just waste all this time and energy about, well, you know, no, I didn't say that, or, you know, this was how it went down. And then, let's have a look at the camera. Or, guys, let's replay that conversation as we were discussing the decision. Mate, the camera and the microphone don't lie, and it becomes pretty apparent pretty quickly what really happened. So that was just an amazing learning tool. And so I've found that fascinating, because now you can really go back and listen in. And okay, yeah, it probably feels good to listen into the good moments, but man, what an awesome opportunity to learn in those tough moments and see where did it go wrong here, you know? And it becomes obvious real quick, but you've got to have a pretty good environment to do that, you know, because you got to make yourself pretty vulnerable. You're going to look, at times it's going to be quite painful to have to go through some of those moments again, but they're typically the moments where you can have the most growth if you're able to be super honest and candid with yourself and your teammates around you to set up that, let's say, kind of an environment.
Yeah, that's absolutely brilliant. Thanks, Jimmy.
Great question, Russ, that brought out a fantastic answer from you, Jimmy. You just spoke about risk there and managing risk. And if David Solnick is here to put your question directly to Jimmy, let's hear from you, David.
Yes, hi. This is a real treat. Thanks for doing this, everybody. So, Jimmy, you're certainly known as a, you know, by others as being a big risk taker. And you know, I wonder whether, you know, that's other people looking at you. And so I'm sort of wondering how you look at yourself, whether you see yourself as a big risk taker, or whether the risks that you, the risks that others, that the rest of us see you take, are just sort of a natural outgrowth of your training and self-confidence and where you're coming from. I mean, do you like go into it, you know, do you go into a situation thinking, yeah, I'm really gonna, you know, I'm really gonna, you know, at a pre-start, you know, really, you know, this is where my aggression is really going to shine, or is it just you know, a more natural outgrowth of who you are and your background and training?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think risk is viewed differently by a lot of people, and so for me, I calculated risk for sure. You know, I enjoy calculated risk. And I see risk in a couple of ways. Like, I would say sitting on the couch and doing nothing would be real risky, because what are you really learning about yourself in that situation, you know? And so for me, risk is not going out in an irresponsible way and just sort of, you know, going gung-ho, going out and you know, that kind of risk. To me, calculated risk is a really fascinating part. But also, I think the risk of, you know, putting yourself out there, putting yourself on the line, the competition, in some ways, that's a bit of a risk because you're going to be judged one way or another. But for me, when putting yourself out there in those sort of situations is really where I've found you learn the most about yourself. You know, I mean, you don't learn much about yourself sitting on the couch at home. You know, it takes something to go out there and, you know, yeah, there is risk out there, but for me, it's calculated. You know, I really think long and hard with a really great group of people around me about what we're going to take on, how we're going to do it. And a few mates of mine who are in the military, you know, and like special forces in the military, I remember it just sticking in my mind where he said, listen, you need to get comfortable being uncomfortable, you know? And so while at that, and look, let's face it, they do life and death risk, but their approach in some ways, the way they approach certain scenarios isn't that much different. I mean, the consequences are, but it isn't that much different to us when we go into, you know, a high pressure sporting moment, you know, of trying to calculate the risk, set up a way of operating and communication, how we assess, you know, that risk and situation, and then making a decision. So yeah, for me, do I like risk? I do like adrenaline-based things, no doubt about it, but I like the calculated side of it. I find it fascinating. And I'll give you an example. You know, I did an underwater breathing program, you know, like a freediving course with a bunch of big wave surfers from Red Bull. Totally, you know, sorry about the pun, threw myself in the deep end. And, you know, that's something I've been never good at. You know, I could probably hold my breath for, I don't know, 15, 20 seconds. But it was, and my view on, let's say, big wave surfers was, you know, I was thinking, yeah, probably a little bit, yeah, the huge risk takers, just get out there, off you go. But you've never seen a more prepared bunch of athletes that turn over every single stone, and this course being one of them. And just to see how they're approaching, you know, let's face it, a life and death situation, the way they build themselves up to what is seen by so many, you know, is actually really calculated by them. And they give themselves such a high percentage chance of success through everything they're doing, and these free dive courses and these techniques and their fitness and their safety teams, the communication flow, and like all these pieces to the puzzle that you really had no idea. Actually reduces the way I look at what they're doing is actually really small, the amount of risk. So yeah, I think it just comes down to the preparation leading up to whatever you're doing. But what can be perceived as quite risky is actually can be quite calculated, and at the end of the day, really reduce that risk.
David, thank you very much for a great question. Thank you, David. Now we're on the hour. Jimmy, put your hand up if you want to tap out. I want to keep you going a little bit longer, but you can put your hand up if you want.
Andy, I'm never, ever going to tap out.
Right, you're in. Now, has your heart rate ever been over 100 beats per minute? And if so, what was the activity that did that?
I think Hamish might have had a match point on the paddle court against me, and just the fear of what I would have to go through the following day, I'm pretty sure it was well over that.
Well, we must make sure that you're wearing heart rate monitors for the world to see the next time you guys go and get on the court together. Fantastic. So
an interesting summary from my perspective, Jimmy, is, you know, we've seen a few comments in the chat box about, you know, the surprise, I guess, that the fact that you haven't really been totally engaged from an early stage with a sports psychologist, and we're asking you to hear to talk about your mental skills training. and fortitude. And I think it reminds me a little bit, as I said, about what we had with the starting. But when I hear what you've got to say, it really feels to me like you've spent your lifetime studying mental skills in a big way. And as you say, at the real most confrontational aspect, where there is no hiding in a boxing ring, and you are fully exposed. And I think that, you know, for me, what you've spoken of throughout this hour has all been about your understanding and your incredible understanding of mental skills and how it applies across the whole range. You know? Everything I felt down when we talked about mental skills and Road to Gold, I sort of said to Andy at the beginning, you know, it's everything. It's in every single chapter, all 12 chapters, because you have to have that attitude. So you almost, we sort of introduced it in the beginning with the idea that you need to keep applying it. We applied a chapter at the end, but really what you're saying, it encompasses everything you do as an athlete.
Yeah, thanks, Hamish.
My conclusion.
Hamish, that's a great summary of what we've just heard from Jimmy. Now, Hamish, we've got Aaron McIntosh on next week. So just tell us a little bit about Aaron and what he brings to the game.
Well, Aaron is Aaron Doran and Kieran and their international squad of windsurfers have applied this squad training approach for a long, long time, really, really successfully. And it's one of the things that we talk about in Road to Gold. You know, we want to see people training in their own backyard with their mates and getting good enough to take on the world. And Aaron, you know, and Dorian and Kieran exemplify that more than anything. And in the final, this final run into the Olympics, they had their trials was the World Championships. And probably everybody might know this, but they finished first and second in every single one of those trials, first and second at the Worlds. And then the final, you know, this was the 2 years that they were now even. And the final trials was the Worlds, and they were first and second. And Dorian bowed out, you know, with his two gold medals, and Kieran has taken the baton on. Now, I mean, there's a lot, there's going to be a lot to be heard. And I just think just the way that people work together as competitors to get better will be fascinating.
Hamish, thanks for that insight into what we're going to be talking about next week. Jimmy, what we're seeing in Olympic training at the moment, Hamish has just given that example in the RSX men. We're seeing the same with the Kiwi Finn sailors winning the last two Finn Gold Cups, and Andy Maloney, the reigning world champion, not actually going because his training partner, Josh Jr., is going to the games. We've heard a lot about honesty and vulnerability from you, but that's often easier said than done. How do you, in your experience, bring out the best in a team rather than get everyone going sharp elbowed on each other and trying to edge each other out of the team?
Well, it doesn't happen overnight, that's for sure. You know, it definitely takes time, but I think early on in any project or campaign, really identifying what are some of the, let's say, foundations for, you know, whether it's an Olympic, well, I've never done the Olympics, but, you know, whether it's a campaign or, you know, what sort of a project you're going into, you know, what you think are going to be important ways of operating, you know. And so what an example that is with, you know, you mentioned Andy and Josh, and what an incredible culture and environment they set up in that program, where completely supportive, completely been open, and you know, you could imagine the learning between those two guys by doing that, you know, by essentially just throwing all the cards on the table and then saying, okay, well, whoever doesn't get the spot, you know, you can imagine how tough that is. That person's gonna you know, back the other guy up. That's the ultimate, you know. So obviously for them to reach that sort of a place, and again, I'm not involved there, so I'm only imagining this and looking from the outside, but I would guess early on when they started that campaign, they would have laid down those ground rules, you know, like, okay, look, if we're going to do this, how about we set this path up like this. You know, we're going to be totally open and honest. We're going to throw all our cards on the table. We're going to push one another. But whoever doesn't make it, we both buy into the process that that guy's going to become the, let's say, the coach slash training partner, and you're working together on a goal like that. So, you know, I think, again, the culture of how you set up that program at the beginning is fundamental. You know, you can't build a good house without a good foundation, and clearly that's what they did.
Jimmy, great summary. A fantastic hour that you've given to us. Hamish, I know you've enjoyed it every bit as much as I have. Thanks for bringing Jimmy to our enthusiastic bunch of Road to Goalsters. We've had some great questions come out, and Jimmy, every time, you absolutely give us an amazing answer back, and your passion for everything you do shines through. So with that, we thank you very, very much. We wish you the best for the next 2 weeks, and we will be coming back to test you on your knowledge of the road to gold in the future. So good luck with the learning, and we hope to do this again with you sometime. And for you Road to Goldsters, we'll see you this time next week when Hamish and I will be talking to another one of the best coaches in the world, Aaron McIntosh. We'll see you then. Bye for now.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks very much.